All of us commit felonies against the English language from time to time, some of us more often than others. But linguist Jeffrey Nunberg argues that the worst offense against language is to fail to listen to it closely. Instead of playing gotcha on misusages, mangled syntax, and mispronunciations, Nunberg says that the words we use and the way we use them can tell us a lot about us and about our times. Why, he wonders, do we refer to white people as Caucasians? How did plastic evolve from a miracle of technology to the symbol of superficiality? What can we learn from the modern euphemisms for war, from teenagers' use of the word like, or the sudden popularity of royal, ratchet, and slated? Why has liberty given way to freedom? Later in the program, amid new allegations against Ahmed Chalabi, Jane Meyer joins us to talk about her profile of the Iraqi leader in this week's New Yorker called The Manipulator. But first, language, politics, and culture. If you have questions about the words and phrases we use and why we use them, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And Jeffrey Nunberg joins us now. He's a linguist at Stanford University whose voice may be familiar to you from his commentaries on NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. He's with us from the studios of member station WNYC in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
Let me ask you about the title of your book. It is going, and I'm not sure I can pronounce this properly, going nuclear. Did I get that right?
You got it right, which is to say wrong.
This is the mispronunciation of the word spelled and properly pronounced nuclear that presidents have struggled with, well, I guess since Dwight Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower was the first, certainly made it famous or infamous, the mispronunciation nuclear.
and he was then succeeded by presidents. Bill Clinton couldn't get it right about half the time.
Bill Clinton got it right about half the time, or wrong about half the time. Carter, some people sometimes thought was saying nuclear, but really he said something more like nuclear, which was had more to do with Georgia than a mispronunciation itself.
Jimmy Carter, of course, a nuclear engineer
from
the United States Navy, yes.
Yeah.
Then we come to the case of George W. Bush, and George W. Tends to pronounce the word, much the way that President Eisenhower did. Let's listen to what George W. Bush, how his pronunciation of the word went across earlier today in his speech to the graduating class at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Third, we're using all the elements of our national power to deny terrorists the chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons they seek.
Now, that wasn't too bad.
Well, that was nuclear. Yeah, he nailed it. The interesting thing about George W. Bush's pronunciation of the word is that George H.W. Bush, his father, had no problem with it. And W. must have grown up hearing it spoken at the dinner table in Kennebunkport. After all, this is a family, not like, say, Clinton's family, where the word would have been used a lot. So Bush heard it used properly when he was growing up. He went to Andover. He went to Yale. I'm sure he heard it used properly there. And in his case, saying nuclear rather than nuclear isn't just a typo, the linguistic equivalent of a typo. It's more on the order of a thinko. That is to say, it's a deliberate choice.
Calculated,
what I think of as a faux bubba pronunciation.
Or going back to maybe his days in college away to for a man who saw himself as a Texan to stick it to those, what you describe as Eastern dweebs.
The Eastern dweebs, yeah. And in fact, this is a pronunciation that Bush is not alone in this. Les Aspin said it that way. And it's a pronunciation you actually hear frequently among Defense Department types. I have an old college friend who comes from New Jersey and went to Columbia and MIT, who works at one of the federal agencies, is an expert in this area. He says nuclear. I said, well, how can you say nuclear? You grew up saying this word properly. He says, well, I only say nuclear when I'm talking about nukes.
So a bit of swagger in that.
There's a bit of swagger, yeah.
Speaking of, I guess I shouldn't leap from Eastern dweeb straight to Senator John Kerry, but his speaking style has also gained some attention, but for a different reason.
Yeah, Kerry's Kerry's misfortune, I think, to have been born into an age that valued a kind of informal, easy communication that he isn't really gifted at doing. So I think Kerry's perceived as with a kind of stiffness that makes it difficult for people to identify with him.
Hmm. You talk about this book is subtitled Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times, and one of the things you write about, a fair amount of euphemisms in the war on terror and the war in Iraq, and each side in the political debate, the campaign seems to have catchphrases that it deploys from time to time almost as weaponry. You have a piece in the book about how Arnold Schwarzenegger used the phrase special interests during his campaign for governor of California. This is a phrase we usually hear from Democrats.
Yeah, oh, well, the Republicans use it, too. You know, there was a time when special interest meant large moneyed concerns, the trusts and so on and so forth. Now it's used for any group where you want to suggest that the group is exerting undue influence on the making of policy or law. So it's as, you know, people use special interest as easily of, say, a feminist organization as of a corporate organization. And in that sense, the word has changed meaning a great deal over the last 50 years.
So a lot of our politicians are in the pursuit of pejoratives.
Right, right, yeah.
One of the interesting ones that you analyze at some length was the origins of the phrase regime change.
Yeah, that's an interesting phrase. It popped obviously enormously in the press in the months and the year or so before the Iraq War. And regime itself is an interesting word. It's a word we only use when we're talking about unstable, slightly suspicious governments. Even when we talk about democratic regimes, you know, we'll talk about democratic regimes in South America, but not in Europe. Europe doesn't have democratic regimes. It just has democracies. So regimes, there's always an implication of instability and perhaps illegitimacy. We more often identify regimes by the names of the leaders than by the countries. We're more likely to speak of the Castro regime or maybe the Havana regime than the Cuban regime. Then we'll talk about the Cuban government. So there's always this implication. And in fact, when you do the counts, the governments most likely to be described by regimes are the ones that are to which the United States is most hostile and that are most immediately subject to a military action, the Sandinistas, Saddam Hussein, and so forth.
We tend to think of this in modern terms, but you also point out that this, at least regime, goes back to the French Revolution, the mother of all regime changes, as you described.
Right, exactly, and to the phrase "ancien régime," which appeared around that time.
And
ever since then, there's been a sense of a regime as something that might be toppled any day now.
An email from Adam Kipiniak, I hope I got that right, in St. Paul, Minnesota. Before the run-up to the war, I don't remember hearing the term weapons of mass destruction, he writes. I don't favor that word for its ambiguity. I'm sure he meant phrase. I prefer descriptive terms like nuclear, biological, and chemical to group together a hydrogen bomb and a canister of sarin gas under one umbrella term as if they were comparable weapons. Does not make a great deal of sense to me. Do you know the history and origin of the term WMD?
You know, I believe it was used in military jargon for some time before it became, you know, widely known a few years ago. But it's an odd locution. I mean, you know, a bomb, a conventional bomb that might kill a few hundred or a few thousand people even is not a weapon of mass destruction. Whereas a canister of gas might be.
I think we had a conversation once with a weapons expert. He traced it back to a UN treaty which was seeking to ban weapons of mass destruction and lump them together like that.
That's quite possible.
All right. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Larry's with us from Fremont, California.
Hi. I noticed about the time of the 9/11 hearing, this expression suddenly popped up, shaking the trees. And I'd never heard it before, and it wasn't too hard to figure out what it meant, but it seemingly came out of nowhere. And the only parallel I could think of was the old expression, shaking the bushes.
Hmm.
What do you know about this expression? Why do you think it caught on so quickly?
This was the use here was they would call a principals meetings, and then the principals would go and shake the trees and for information or intelligence about
exactly
what might happen.
What do you think it means?
Jeffrey Nunberg?
Well, I think that is what it means to rustle about and trying to find out what you can find out. But it's interesting the way these expressions, whether in a military life, political life, or to a large extent in corporate life, these metaphors just pop up one after another. And they're more almost a kind of corporate slang, I think, than any real changes in the language. They appear out of nowhere, they're popular for a while, and then they evanesce.
Hmm. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Jim. Jim's with us from Massillon, Ohio.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Well, three categories here. I'll do them real quickly. First, I guess I'll call it the category of the cachet of erudition. And that seems to be like words like exacerbate and robust have just been used to death for the last 2 or 3 years. The second category are I guess, it's sort of a process of leveling where I'm a teacher myself, and the use of the word kids to mean anything, a young person or a student or a child or an adolescent or whatever, kid just seems to be a word that almost has no meaning. It's used in so many. And the third area is the non-replacement. And this would be the phrase, no problem, used instead of you're welcome.
Hmm. Any thoughts on those, Jeffrey?
Yeah, no, I think robust, for example, is an instance of one of those vogue words that for one reason or another is just picked up and people like the sound of it. You're right. I don't know if it's erudition, but there's a kind of pleasure in saying a word like that and everybody plugs into it. Royal's a word. There's a piece in this book about the word royal, R-O-I-L, which for some reason became about 10 times as more frequent over the last two decades as it was in 1980. And why is that? Well, it's hard to know. I mean, journalists like it for headlines. It's a short word with only four letters, and two of them are skinny. But words like this are really like fashions. You may as well ask why hemlines drop or rise, or why one day every teenager in America comes to school wearing Pumas. There's no rhyme or reason for it, except to say that corporate and military and political types are generally more more conformist than the average teenager is.
It's important that you spelled it, otherwise we might think it had referred to the regime which was changed in 1789.
Right, right. Yeah.
Jim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. An email question. What has spell check done to learning about words by need to use the dictionary?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I use spell check because it picks up all sorts of typos that I wouldn't otherwise have spotted. I think, in a certain sense, people really didn't use the dictionary as much as we like to think they did, and they do use the spell checker. And the problem I see with it, when my daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, uses it, is that there are all these words like there, T-H-E-I-R, and T-H-E-R-E, that aren't distinguished by the spell checkers, and I keep seeing those errors recurring in her papers. Not that looking in a dictionary would help her there either.
Probably not. It's interesting, though, you point out in your introduction that linguists, people tend to, you know, ask questions about words like antimacassar, and linguists are actually more interested in the use of the words like the.
Yeah, that's what makes linguists different from everybody else. We're the ones who think the most interesting words are words like the and not things like verisimilitude or serendipity or antimacassar, these exotic words that everybody else has in mind when they say they think language is so fascinating.
What used to be called $40 words back when $40 meant a lot of money.
Right, and for us, it's the nickel words that do the real work.
We're talking about what language usage can tell us about politics, culture, and our troubled times. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, the address, TOTN@NPR.org. Our guest is Jeffrey Nunberg. His book is Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Back after a short break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how the words we use inform us about our times. Our guest is Jeffrey Nunberg. He's the author, most recently, of Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times, familiar to you, perhaps, as a commentator on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go to Steve, who's with us from Wadi, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hi.
I have, first of all, a comment to say about shaking the trees. We used to work in orchards for apples and oranges, and that's what they'd call that, dropping the information, is we'd shake the trees for the information. And then we use it in the military later on. Also, I would like to find out about the word inflammable. I'm told that Webster's Dictionary was going to change the meaning of it to mean non-flammable because so many people were getting injured, but I haven't found it changed in any of the dictionaries yet. Do you know anything about that?
You know, it's one of those words. I think we had a usage note about it, in fact, in the American Heritage Dictionary, the third edition. It's one of those words that, yeah, in true, in theory, inflammable means subject to being set on fire rather than... not flammable, but it's not the kind of you could be a purist about it, but you're going to lose a lot of your personnel along the way. So it's not the kind of distinction that it makes sense to try to maintain unless everybody's going to go there.
I should point out that Jeffrey Nunberg, among his many credentials, is chair of the usage panel at the American Heritage Dictionary, which is why he mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Steve. And let's try to go to Jay in Kansas City.
Hello. I'm interested to know if there is an alternative phrase for out-of-the-box thinking.
Well, there's always been unconventional, hasn't there? In fact, one of the things about out-of-the-box that's most striking is that the word use of that word suggests a conventionality that's precisely the opposite of what's meant to suggest, what the phrase is meant to mean.
A little bit like inflammable in some usages, too.
Right, right, yeah. And if somebody says we're going to do some out-of-the-box thinking, you can bet they're thinking along pretty much the same lines that everybody else is.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. The misusage that you do get upset about, and you're not really playing gotcha all the time, but that is Simon Winchester, when he was on the program, also mentioned this to us, enormity, which is being used to mean hugeness as opposed to meaning something truly terrible.
Yeah, you know, it's one of these things. I mean, we all have. I don't like hearing disinterested used to mean uninterested and so on. I tend to greet those things with an ironic shrug rather than becoming indignant and waving my finger in the air. But I have always done a kind of inward wince when I hear somebody using enormity to mean just large size. I saw a reference a while ago to the enormity of Joe DiMaggio's contribution to baseball. And I say, well, you know, us National League fans would be more likely to use enormity to describe the contribution of George Steinbrenner to baseball. And it was really striking because immediately after 9/11, I did these counts, actually, in the press, and I went and saw how often the word was used correctly, as I'd like to think of it. And, you know, about two-thirds of the time until 2001, it was used incorrectly. It had just basically the large size sense was the standard sense of the word. After 9/11, there was this sudden jump in correct uses of the words, as if suddenly we realized that as we were desperately looking for words to do justice to our sense of the horror and awfulness of what had taken place, here was this word sitting right there. I compare it to a plate that you're looking around for and you discover it's been sitting under a flower pot for the last 10 years and you suddenly need it. And in that sense, the word has been, in a certain sense, restored, though I don't think it'll last. I think that one's a lost cause.
But you do point out that in that crisis, many of us were literally at a loss for words, yet those of us in the media rushed in to fill the void, often with cliches, but rushed in to fill the void nevertheless.
Right. That's true. I mean, in fact, the words we have, it's striking that the words we use to describe things that are particularly shocking are words that suggest our inability to describe them, indescribable, unspeakable, unutterable. Those were the words that people were often using after 9/11. Or the other thing that people were doing that I thought was interesting is they were going back to the Victorian period to look for this old-fashioned language of villainy. President Bush called the attacks despicable, which has a kind of Victorian Daffy Duck kind of sound to it. Nefarious was a word you heard.
Dastardly.
Craven, as if only this old-fashioned Victorian sense of indignation, the language of that period, was adequate to do justice to what was going on. And it was precisely, I think, because a lot of the language that we should have been using, words like ghastly and monstrous or enormity, had been themselves debased as just ordinary coins, so that we had to go back to that period to look for this older sense of moral order.
Let's speak now with Candy, who's with us from Spokane, Washington.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could speak to the changes in the word gay over the last 50 years. It started out meaning something that was happy-go-lucky or pleasant and turned into a homosexual person, and now it's used to disturb or by teenagers to describe anything that's plebeish or geeky or, you know, just out of
lame might be what you yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that sense of gay to refer chiefly to homosexual males, although it's sometimes used for women as well. Came in, as best people can tell, sometime in the 1930s or 1940s as a word in the what we would now describe as the gay subculture. It burst into the national media in the mid-60s and became, for most people, the standard way to describe the culture that's grown up around homosexuality in America. And you're right, the teenagers now use it in a way that means something like lame. My daughter uses it that way, and she's kind of embarrassed about using it, and she's, oh, well, I don't mean it that way, Dad, and so on. But it's an interesting shift, that last change.
Hmm. Yeah, my 13-year-old niece uses it to describe anybody she doesn't like.
Yeah. No, and here, even in San Francisco, which is a politically correct place and where people take that very seriously, kids are using it in that sense as well.
Thanks, Candy.
Thank you.
Talking about kids' usage, one of the most commented upon of your commentaries was one about the word like. As an example, here's Margaret Cho, who appeared with us here on Talk of the Nation in an interview, explaining her view on how Asians are portrayed in the media. And listen in, focus on how many times she uses the word like.
I mean, it's a weird thing. I mean, because whenever you see minorities on television, especially Asian people, it's like, you know, the only time I ever see Asians on TV is when there's trouble down in Chinatown and they've got to take care of it. You know, it's like always a crime show issue where there's Chinese gangs taking over. And you never see, like, just Asian people on television just being there or being a family or just, you know, not having to always explain their race every second. You know, that's sort of the trouble with minorities in television is that we're at the stage now where people are only there to explain their existence, where you don't see, like, minorities in life explaining their existence.
You were actually right about a couple of different uses of the word like, and that they shouldn't be, we should not leap to the barricades and try to defend the language against it.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting usage. That first sense, the kind of hedge sense where mm-hmm. it's used as a modifier or softeners. Well, it's one I use, in, you know, even in email, I'll say, do you suppose we could, like, talk about it? And it invests a sentence with a certain ironic detachment. Or you say, could I, like, borrow your sweater? It's a kind of a way of mollifying or softening a request. That's something that came originally from the hipsters and was sort of passed into the standard language from the hipsters to the disc jockeys to the television shows, characters like Kooky on 77 Sunset Strip. Or
lend me your comb.
Yeah, Kooky, lend me your car. He was always saying like, or you remember...
I also said daddy-o, and that didn't survive.
That didn't make it, no, nor did Solid. Bob Denver on that show, The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, mm-hmm. Was a late 50s show. He played a hippie, a beatnik wannabe called Maynard G. Krebs, who was always given to saying things like wow, that is like really like cool. So it passed into teenage slang. It instantly became... for grown-ups, a mark of everything that was wrong with our nation's young people, every lax standards in television and bad manners and mindlessness and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, kids continue to use it and use it in this very deliberate way. It isn't really a mindless tick, and they can turn it off when they want to. And then later on, around the 70s, this new sense of like, where it was, this is the use in a sentence like, so I was like, you've got to be kidding, and she was like, ooh, and so on, which also drives grown-ups crazy, but also does a lot of work. What follows that like isn't a report of what somebody said. It's a little performance. It kind of marks the dramatizations that are particularly characteristic of adolescent speech. So I think both of those uses of like are kind of interesting. The language is going somewhere with that. Kids will use it without commenting on it, and they will have a hard time even understanding why we were so indignant or irate about it. In the same way that, our parents were indignant about the way we use swell, for example.
And but that one didn't make it either. Let's get another caller on the line. Harvey joins us from Learned, Kansas.
Hi, this is Harvey. I enjoy your program. I'm a truck driver. You were talking about shaking the trees earlier, and there's a great deal of significance back in that from hunting. Anything you could chase with dogs, be it possum or cougar or jaguar or...
Raccoon, maybe?
Raccoons, of course, yeah. And out west, black bear even. You had to go up the tree after it to get it out. You shook it off the limb. You shook it out of the tree, and it's easy to see how it was attributed to military purposes when it comes to intelligence or snipers or anything that'd be hiding in the trees. On the other hand, biologists use it also. They used to have to cut limbs, shake the trees to get the bugs out, find out what they had.
I can hear Jeffrey Nunberg taking notes. I think I hear a commentary.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. What's interesting, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing to say, what's interesting is that a phrase that's been around in hunting or in ordinary speech for a long time suddenly becomes a vogue like that, and for a couple of months or a couple of years, everybody's talking about shaking the trees, or that dog won't hunt, another expression that goes back forever, but all of a sudden became a politically... voguish word a couple of years ago. That expression a couple of years ago. That's the process that I guess I'm interested in. Mm.
Harvey, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Enjoy your show.
And Jeffrey Nunberg, I'm not going to let you go without letting you take a swat at the media, particularly when I was curious, maybe getting back to Joe DiMaggio. You draw the distinction between what sports stars used to be called, which were heroes, as opposed to legends.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The word legend has basically it's a relatively new word in this sense of somebody who's famous, particularly in the sense of somebody who's been celebrated by the media. And it's more or less driven out hero. Even when people now are talking about people like Lou Gehrig or Ted Williams, they're more likely to call him a legend than a hero. I was very struck by the fact that after Williams died, Bush the elder called him a great hero, and his son called him a baseball legend. And that strikes me as an indication of the way in which the media are becoming the chief negotiators of fame or mediators of fame, so that you can be an unsung hero, but you can't be an unsung legend.
I was curious. The elder Bush might have called him a hero not just for his baseball exploits, but of course he was a pilot in the Second World War and in
Korea. He was a pilot, and when people mentioned his being a hero after his death, they almost always brought that into play, as if it wasn't his doings on the baseball field weren't sufficient to make him heroic. But 30 or 40 years ago, nobody had any problem describing somebody like Lou Gehrig as a hero or Babe Ruth as a hero or talking about a football hero.
Jeffrey Nunberg is our language hero. We thank him for his time today.
Thank you so much.
Jeffrey Nunberg's book is called Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Now I'm going to mispronounce it for the rest of my life. He spoke with us from the studios of member station WNYC in New York.